box houses, the bare minimum to get a family through until more permanent housing could be built. Earthquake shacks. The permanent houses were never built, and over the years the Fillmore had become a slum, where the poorest people outside of Chinatown lived. For a while it was Japantown, until the Japanese were shipped off to internment camps during the war. Then for a short while it became a ghost town, until housing was needed by defense workers faster than it could be built at Hunter's Point, Richmond, and Marin City. And so around 43, the Fillmore filled up with black families moving from the south for work. That's when the cops started calling it Darktown. It was still a poor neighborhood, a lot of broken-down earthquake shacks, but it was still a neighborhood. Home for a lot of people who couldn't move away even if they could afford to, because zoning laws wouldn't allow black people to live in most other neighborhoods in the city. Some people treated those rented earthquake shacks as if they owned them, and turned them into little jewel boxes with fresh paint, manicured postage-stamped lawns, and window boxes filled with flowers. Around 3 a.m., Sammy pulled up in front of just such a home. The two windows on either side of the front door shone yellow in the fog, just frosting the tops of some red geraniums in the windows with light. "We're here," Sammy said. He jumped out of the Ford and headed toward the cottage. When he was halfway down the walk, he looked back to see Myrtle, sitting motionless in the passenger seat, and Pookie, equally motionless, but for different reasons, in the rumble seat. Sammy went back to get her. She'd locked the door. "We're here," Sammy said, knocking on the window. "Come on, this is it."
"Where are we?"
"Friend's house. Guy I bailed out in a fight once."
"It doesn't feel safe."
"Really? You're gonna love Lone." Sammy coaxed her out of the car and escorted her up the walk, Myrtle clutching her little overnight bag against her chest like a schoolgirl carrying books. Sammy knocked on the door.
"It's kind of late," Myrtle said.
"It's fine. Lights are on. Lone is just off work." The lock clicked. The door swung open, and Lone Jones stepped into the doorway, still in his tucked shirt and trousers, eclipsing the light from inside the house. Myrtle yipped and jumped back.
"Hey, Sammy," Lone said around a mouthful of something substantial he was chewing.
He had a dish towel tucked in his collar as a napkin.
"Come on in."
Lone stepped out of the doorway and held the door with a slight bow, which still left his head above the doorframe.
"Evening, miss,"
Lone said to Myrtle, reaching for the brim of his top hat, which he was not wearing. Habit. Myrtle tried to take a wide path through the door, which wasn't possible because it was a narrow door, and ended up tripping over her own feet and into the tiny parlor. Sammy caught her by the elbow and steadied her. "Myrtle, this is Thelonious Jones. Lone, this is Myrtle. She's in a spot and I need you to look out for her. Keep it on the QT."
"A pleasure, miss," said Lone Jones.
"Charmed," said Myrtle, her eyes going wide enough to admit a pair of ghosts.
"Sorry to show up so late," Sammy said. "Ain't no thing," said Lone. "We was up."
Lone looked out to the street before closing the door.
"You get a new car, Snowflake?"
"Borrowed it from a friend."
"You get a new friend?"
"In a manner of speaking, I guess so," Sammy said.
"That the police I bust upside the head in the rumble seat?"
"That it is," said Sammy, looking past Lone to see if Pookie was moving. He wasn't. A woman's voice from down the hall.
"Is that Sammy?"
Myrtle jumped.
"Hey, Mrs. Jones," Sammy called. "Mama got up and made me a meatloaf," said Lone, "since I can't go to cookies after work no more."
"For a while," said Sammy.
"Y'all want to come in the kitchen and watch me eat a meatloaf?"
"Sure," said Sammy. Lone bowed again, ever the professional, and presented the narrow hall with a flourish. "After y'all." Sammy pushed Myrtle, who moved in tiny resistant steps down the hallway, and into a small kitchen, where a petite black woman in a housecoat and hairnet was tending to a tea kettle at the stove. There was a drop-leaf table under a little window with enough room for a chair on either side. One side was set with a dinner plate, where half a fork-worried meatloaf stood amid a mound of mashed potatoes that looked like a meaty ship that had crashed into an iceberg of steaming spuds. Mrs. Jones shuffled over to Sammy. She wore fuzzy slippers and walked as if they would slip off her feet if she dared to lift them from the floor. She fluffed Sammy's shoulders, then stepped back and took a look at him.
"That's a sharp suit, Sammy, but you're skinny. Thelonious is taking good care of you."
"He sure is, Mrs. Jones. Don't know how I get by without him."
"Well, that's good. You know, I told that boy, He don't take care of you, he ain't never gonna get him a wife. When he was little, he got a little catfish out the creek. Little itty-bitty thing. Lived in a bowl by his bed. Well, it done died.
Wasn't my fault, said Loon, now looming over the meatloaf.
So you say, snapped Mrs. Jones at her son. I didn't allow him no pets after that until he come home with you. Boy was so excited, and you were so beat up and sad, I didn't have the heart to say no to neither one of you.
I'm glad you didn't, ma'am, Sammy said.
Now who this?
Mrs. Jones looked Myrtle up and down. Myrtle curtsied, nearly dropped her overnight bag.
I'm Myrtle, ma'am. You Sammy's girl?
No, Mrs. Jones, Sammy said. Myrtle's a friend. She's in some trouble. Nothing she did, but some bad guys are looking for her. I was hoping she could stay with you and Thelonious until the trouble blows over.
I suppose so, said Mrs. Jones.
Nobody will look for her here in Darktown. That's what I'm hoping, Sammy said.
Well, let's get her situated. I got church in the morning.
She can sleep on the couch, Mama, said Lone.
You can sleep on the Davenport, she guessed.
I don't fit on the Davenport, Mama.
You will sleep on the Davenport and get a young lady your bed, or I will whoop your ass, Thelonious W. Jones.
Sammy nudged Myrtle and whispered, So you'll be fine. Everybody's looking out for you.
It's okay, Myrtle said,
seeming to relax for the first time.
I like the couch. I'll be fine on the couch.
Thelonious W. Jones, Sammy said. That's new. What's the W stand for, Lone?
You don't need to know, Mama. Don't you tell him.
Wedgwood, said Mrs. Jones. Thelonious Wedgwood Jones. It's a nice name, said Myrtle. Sounds British, fancy. The Wedgwood is Daddy's idea.
Oh, Mama, you don't got to tell that story.
Lone dropped his fork into his mashed potatoes.
Colonia's conceived on top a Wedgwood stove, said Mrs. Jones. Right there in the kitchen where I was working, Lonia's daddy, may he rest in peace, just come up on me talking sweet like he did.
Don't tell that, Mama.
Lone unfolded from his chair, was across the kitchen in two strides, and back up the hall toward his bedroom. Come this way, miss, I'll show you my room. Mrs. Jones leaned into Myrtle conspiratorially.
That man had a dick like a dinosaur.
Oh, Mama.
You seen pictures of dinosaurs? Just like that. I mean, they don't show they dicks in the pictures, but you know they big. Man like to split me in two. Don't get me wrong, I got used to it, but them first few times, well, it was a surprise.
You like one pillow or two? Lone called from the little room off the hall.
I got two. You can have them both if you want. I'm sure that's why I couldn't have no children after Lonius. That man ruined me. He wasn't tall as Lonius, but that man dick a menace.
Mama, please, Lone called.
Don't get me wrong. Lonnie's got a respectable dick on him, too. Take him half an hour to wash it sometime. But not like his daddy's.
Well, I better be going, Sammy said. I have a drive ahead of me.
You want me to make you a cup of coffee, Sammy? Look like Lonnie's ain't gonna finish his meatloaf. If you're hungry, I can fix you a sandwich to take.
That would be great, Mrs. Jones. Mama, he said he got to go.
Myrtle, you hungry? A sandwich would be nice.
Myrtle said, more at ease now than was Lonius in his own home.
I think that's why he died so young, said Mrs. Jones. Just 32. Man's heart just gave out from having to pump up that big old dino dick.
Mama, Sammy had to go save his lady.
I'm fine, Wedgwood, Sammy said.
I'll whoop your ass, Snowflake.
Don't talk to your white boy like that, Thelonious. They'll never let you on a Secret Service.
Secret Service?
Myrtle said. Lone will explain, said Sammy. Don't tell him about President Roosevelt.
What about President Roosevelt?
You'll see, said Sammy. Loan is a phone. I'll call you, let you know when it's okay to go home. Let Mrs. Jones answer.
Call me when you find Tilly so I won't worry, Myrtle said.
I will, and I'll check in with Jimmy for you. Don't you call him. I think these guys might have a line on the phone. And what was the name of that camp, the one the guard said to check with when you were locked up in the cabin?
Jaggins. I remember because it fit with all their other spooky stuff.
Sammy took her hand and gave it a squeeze. Thanks.
Lone Jones reappeared behind them, filling the hall.
I got Executive Order 8802 from President Roosevelt in a frame in the parlor, Lone said. You want to see it?
That would be swell, Myrtle said. You want ketchup on your meatloaf sandwich, Sammy?
Mrs. Jones asked.
Yes, ma'am, Sammy said.
To Lone, he said in a whisper.
Lone, you see two white guys in black suits coming to the door. You take Myrtle out the back. If you don't have time, don't hesitate.
Do what you have to do.
Always do, Snowflake, said Lone.
10 minutes later, Sammy was checking Pookie's pulse, faint.
He was cold, but alive.
He climbed into the Ford, put the paper sack with a thermos of coffee, cream and sugar, a cup, and a meatloaf sandwich wrapped in wax paper on the seat beside him, then headed across town to Mabel's on Post Street to play the one outside chance that Stilton might have made it back to the city before he charged north into the Redwood Forest. Chapter 19. Sampling Social Clubs of San Francisco. Maybe it speaks to my lack of sophistication, or maybe it speaks to my lack of desperation, but I had never been inside a whorehouse before. I was not apprised of the etiquette, and I was not in the market to purchase some tail. Yet I sensed it would not be kosher to stroll in and announce that I was just browsing, and could I speak to any girls who had recently been on a small bus. I figured I'd come in on the level and hope that would work. After I parked the Ford at the curb on Post outside of Mabel's and smacked Pookie a couple of times to make sure he was breathing but not awake, I sauntered up the stairs of the big Victorian and through beveled glass doors into a grand foyer, where I was greeted by an extra-large gent in a suit who wished me a good morning and inquired if the weight in my jacket pocket was a heater, which I admitted it was.
"Hand it over," said the palooka,
gesturing gimme with his hand. He said this with no malice or threat implied.
"No guns in the house. You'll get it back on the way out."
"Of course," I said, and I handed him the Walther, which he took with two fingers like he was handling a dead bird.
"Walther is a dame's gun," he said.
"That is true," I confirmed. "A dame gives it to me. There's one in the chamber there, sports. You might want to avoid dropping it." He shrugged like that would never happen in a million years, then locked the gun in the top drawer of a credenza made of some dark wood, with a couple of silver candle holders on top, composed of figures of couples entwined in some serpentine razzmatazz.
"Enjoy yourself," said the mug,
waving me through to an expansive parlor, where an abundance of beddies of various shapes and sizes were strewn about, reclining upon furniture, while smoking, looking bored, and discussing the current shortage of gents in need of company, of which there were presently none. My entrance drew an eye from here and there, but only a substantial dame in a green sequined evening dress and enough face paint to refinish a carload of clowns approached. Mabel. I knew her by reputation and description, and she was the only one in the room besides me and the bartender wearing more than her underwear.
"Well, look what luck has brought to our door," said Mabel, tossing a lock of strawberry hair off her shoulder. "What can I do for you, handsome?"
I felt myself flinch a little as Mabel said handsome to me with the same inflection as the cheese, not so much a nickname as a promise. It wasn't that she was older than my mother, which she was. It was the fact that the cheese was wound up in me like a fork in a plate of spaghetti. "It's Sammy," I said. "Sammy Tiffin. I work at Sal Gabelli's place. You got a minute?" A sneer played across Mabel's painted-on smile.
"Step into my office."
She spun on a heel and moved in a hula of green sparkles to the bar, where the bartender handed her a cigarette in a long ivory holder and lit it, while she gave me the once-over like I had all the charm of a wet sneeze. She said,
"You can tell fucking Sal that he owes me."
"Sal's dead," I said, which stopped her mid-threat. "He was..."
"Shh."
She had her hand up, eyes down, and took a slow drag on a cigarette that she let trail out of her nose and the corners of her mouth. "But he..."
"Shh," she said. "Moment of silence."
"Sorry," I said. I let her have her moment, kind of.
"Do you want to say a few words?" I asked.
She nodded, not looking up, paying her respects to Sal as if he were the pattern in the oriental rug. Deep breath.
"He was a douchebag."
"Amen," said the bartender.
"Amen," I repeated.
"Amen," said Mabel.
She dismissed Sal's service with a wave of her cigarette holder.
"So, Sammy Tiffin, where the fuck is Pearl? Where the fuck is my money? What the fuck happened at the Bohemians? And who the fuck were those guys in the black suits who came by here asking questions but giving no answers
and unwilling to relinquish their firearms?" said the bartender. "Don't you want to know what happened to Sal?" I asked.
Does it answer any of my other questions?
Well, his stiff was last seen in the trunk of those guys in the black suits, and I don't know who they are, but they seem very persistent but not particularly sharp. I don't know where your money is, and I don't know where Pearl is, but last time anyone sees her, she is up at the Bohemian Grove with a dame called Stilton, who I am very fond of, and who has not returned either, which is why I am here.
Sorry, kid, Mabel said. Your girl isn't here.
She let that sink in. The bartender slid a note to her, which she looked at quickly, then handed back.
The guys in the black suits wanted to talk to all of my girls who went to the Grove. Wanted to know who and what they saw. I told them that it is their business to see nothing and not remember anyone. But, in matter of fact, my girls never got out of the dining room up there, and didn't talk to anyone but a couple of bartenders. When they inquired further, Mr. Powers, who you met in the foyer, asked them to leave.
The bartender leaned in. At the point of a 12-gauge pump he keeps behind the credenza for just such occasions.
I was suddenly glad I did not give Mr. Powers any trouble when he asked for my heater.
So you haven't heard from your girl, Pearl, either?
I'm afraid not, said Mabel. And I'm worried about her. She had a very particular trick she was going to perform. The kid's got moxie for miles. I think it might have gotten her in trouble.
Mabel must have seen something in the way I reacted to that, because she butted her cigarette and put her hand on my shoulder.
I'd love to help you, kid, but I wasn't lying to those guys. None of my girls saw nothing. I put them through the third degree when they showed up a day early and a dollar short, without Pearl.
I nodded. I'm going up there to find Stilton. If I find your Pearl, I'll bring her home, too.
You're just going to rush into Bohemian Grove and demand they give up your girl?
Nah. I think I know the camp where the guy is that Sal set this whole thing up with. Air Force General. And some knob called Alton Stoddard III.
Liar, Mabel said. Financial district. Money goes back to before the earthquake. One of those guys who never go to court or anything. Just sit behind a big desk in a big office and pull strings. You gonna just run up to him and demand he tell you where your girl is?
I'm new to this kind of thing, but I thought I'd just start shooting parts off him until he tells me.
Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Maybe you'd put one in him for me, even if he tells you right away.
Happy to. None of your girls could help me with the layout of the Grove, could they? Know where the dragon camp is?
I'm afraid not. But the Bohemians got a map of the camp on the wall, down at the clubhouse on Taylor.
How do you know that? I thought dames weren't allowed.
Do I look like the kind of broad lets rules like that get in their way?
She grinned, like a boomerang of lipstick and teeth. Then she bopped my shoulder with the side of her fist, careful not to snag a knuckle duster full of gems on my jacket.
Pull on your chain, kid.
Herb Kane did a spot in that place in the Chronicle. Described the whole caboodle. He said there was a map of the camp on the wall in the front bar. Got it, thanks. I started to go. She called me back.
I'm no kid. If during your adventures you happen to lose Pookie O'Hara in a permanent way, your money will never be any good here.
I shook my head. You know about Pookie?
Mr. Powers sent word about your passenger right after you came in.
Long story, I explained.
Don't care, said Mabel.
You won't say anything?
Discretion is my business.
Then why'd you tell me about Stoddard, the map?
You know what you learn from 30 years of selling sex?
I shook my head.
You learn what a guy in love looks like. You're not my business. You watch your back, kid. Have a word with Mr. Powers as you leave.
I did what she asked, and after Mr. Powers handed the Walther back to me, he said thus,
Cinch up your belt and tuck it in the small of your back. I'd have never known you had a gat if you carried it that way. I don't frisk guys, just ask if it's obvious. Besides, you'll never clear that rod from your jacket pocket in time if you need to use it. So best case, you got one shot before the slide jams on the cloth and you've already ruined your jacket. Get a waistband holster from back there if you're gonna make a habit of it. You still got Pookie's badge?
Yeah, I think so. Another guy took his money and his gun, but I think the badge is with his clothes.
Good. You can use that, said Mr. Powers.
I came through the door to the Bohemian Club with Pookie's badge out in front of me. I didn't announce anything, and there was no doorman. just a very tired bartender who was close to nodding off. The place was empty. A big oak bar with a cut-glass mirror. Lots of empty captain's chairs. A wide arched doorway that led into other arched doorways. From what I could see, it was a lot of wing-backed leather chairs and expensive rugs. Crystal ashtrays and newspapers hung on sticks in a rack. Not a soul in the joint.
"Inspector," said the bartender, "the club has an arrangement with the police. A number of our members are policemen."
"Yeah," I said, letting the badge sag. "Where is everyone?" I'd really been expecting a lot of resistance. A lot of guys with big white mustaches saying, "Now see here, my good man, how dare you?" and so forth. What I got is an exhausted guy of about 60 years in a white waiter's jacket who just wanted to go home, eat breakfast, and hit the hay. The bartender checked his watch. "It's 4:30 in the morning, and even if it wasn't, everyone is up at the Grove. You know that." How would I know that? Was everybody supposed to know that? Has Alton started the third here? I can't tell you that, officer. This is the Bohemian Club. He said it like that explained everything, but I cut him off. I was tired, jangled from coffee, and out of my mind worried about the cheese. So I pulled the Walter from the small of my back, pointed it at his forehead, and cocked the hammer. Strictly speaking, I didn't have to do this to shoot him, but it clarified my intentions somewhat. "Why don't you tell me more about club policy, and I'll stop you when your brains are sprayed all over that mirror?" As soon as I said this, I knew he would be horrified, because, as a bartender myself, I have had to clean a big beveled glass mirror like that, and the idea of having to get it gleaming again after a brain spray, well, it's a nightmare. Also, they were his brains. "He's at the Grove," said the bartender. "I don't know which camp he's staying at. He belongs to Mandalay, though." This was information that meant nothing whatsoever to me. But since he answered my question, I didn't shoot him. "Where's the map of the camp?" I waved the Walder around, a little as I had seen done in various films. The bartender pointed. It was right there on the wall before the big arched doorway. A long rectangle, maybe 1 by 3 feet, with a very detailed hand-lettered map. The Grove was printed above the legend. Each of the camps was marked off, and I spotted the Dragon Camp right away. I tried to pull the map off the wall, frame and all, but it was screwed on. "Give me your ice hammer," I said to the bartender. He started to shrug like he didn't know what I was talking about, and I shrugged right back in the direction of the Walther. "What do you want to do, buddy?" He reached into the well and came back with a silver-plated ice hammer, brought it to the end of the bar and presented it to me, rosewood handle first.
"Silver? Really?"
"We use a meat-tenderizing hammer at Sal's." He shrugged. "The club." I put the gun in my waistband and turned my head as I made quick shards of the glass in the frame. A few touch-up taps to take out some sharp parts around the edges, and I put the ice hammer back in the bar. "Knife?" I said. The bartender started to reach for a wine knife. "Garnish knife," I said. He grabbed a paring knife from a cutting board by the well and placed it gingerly on the bar. "Thanks," I told him. In 4 quick zips, the map was out of the frame, and I had it rolled up and stuffed in the inside pocket of my jacket. I pulled a buck from my pocket and threw it on the bar, along with the paring knife.
"Sorry about the glass. We aren't permitted to accept tips, sir."
"Well, then they ain't paying you enough." I left the buck in the bar and went outside. On the corner, a guy was throwing a bundle of newspapers off a truck. A kid cut the strings in the bundle with a pocket knife.
"Paper, mister?"
said the kid, holding up a morning edition of the Examiner. I waved him off, but when I looked, a 2-column story above the fold announced, "Air Force General's plane crashes outside Napa, 3 dead. "Yeah, give me one, kid." He handed me the paper. I threw him a nickel.
"How about one for your buddy?"
asked the kid, nodding at Pookie. "Nah, he's resting, thanks." 2 quick pinches of Pookie's cheeks to make sure he was still among the quick, but not too quick. I took his hat so it didn't blow off on the highway, and threw it in the newspaper on the seat beside me, with my thermos and my meatloaf sandwich. Then I was in the wind. Chapter 20. The Name of the Snake. The name of the snake is Petey. No need to make a big deal about it. And I am the one who has been telling you this tale when Sammy falls down on the job or doesn't know what's what. See, like I said, I know things. My people know things, but I had to hold out until now to clue you in on my part, because, really, what kind of credibility is a story going to have that starts with a talking snake? Am I right? Of course I am. I'm always right. It's a curse. So before I go any further, since I'm giving you the inside line on this story. Chinatown rats are fucking delicious. You're sliding along, minding your own business, and suddenly, your tongue picks up the taste of five spices, fear, garlic, and chili paste? To die for is all I'm saying. Granted, it is much chillier here in San Francisco than I care for, as I am generally a desert and savanna kind of guy. But I'm comfortable when I can find a spot under a steam pipe, or curl up by a boiler chimney on the roof. They never look for you on the roof. I settled down one night in a pigeon coop a guy keeps on the roof. It was lovely, warm, a little nook to warm up in. All night, the gentle cooing, and a delicious breakfast in bed. Although the pigeon guy did overreact somewhat when he reached in the coop to calm his girls to find me there, smiling, just wanting to wish him top of the morning and thanks to the scrumptious squab. But no, he had to run around making with the shouting and the disturbing grabbing of a broom, and I had no choice but to bite him. Bite, bite, bite. Pump venom. Well, I gotta tell you, he nearly dragged me over the edge when he ran off the roof, and I was barely able to get my fangs out of him before he took the big dive to Splattersville in the alley below. Six stories. Not my fault. I reared up, gave him the tongue flick, and the little head wave. That is the universal signal for, buddy, I'm going to bite the shit out of you. But did he back off? He did not. Rest in peace, pigeon guy. Let me make it clear, lest I give you the impression I am just some murderous thug. I do not like biting people. In fact, like it says in the books, unless I am hunting, I will bite only when threatened. Although I am easily threatened. What are you looking at? Humans are a waste of venom. You can't even eat them. A rat, you bite him 10-20 seconds tops, he's a twitching, delicious snack. A human sometimes takes 6 hours, and even then you can't eat them. I've tried. You get one hand down, maybe up to the elbow. Then you have to barf them up and go find a rodent or bird or something decent to eat. Just for the record, I am not the villain here. I am just the narrator. I gave that old Chinese broad behind the cabbage place fair warning. Fair friggin' warning. She was eyeing my rat. And then she takes a swing at me with a dustpan? Grandma, what am I, some squiggly kid fresh out of the egg? You swing on me, you get the fang. That second guy in the alley tried to grab me as I slid by, which is about six kinds of stupid. Sure, I was forced to give him a little something I'm coming to think of as a San Francisco treat. Bite, bite, bite. Sal. Well, it is well known to one and all that Sal Gabelli was a douchebag and had it coming. See, what Sal doesn't know is that when they put me in a cotton bag in Cape Town, they also throw in a couple of rats, you know, to sustain me through the voyage. But I don't eat them right away because gnawing out of a sack is not among my sordid talents. But it turns out that the rats are quite good at that. So for a couple of days on the ship, we lounge in the sack, tell some tales, have a few laughs, and the rats, to help pass the time, gnaw a hole in the sack. Only then do I bid them a fond farewell and send them off to hors d'oeuvre Valhalla. So yeah, both Sal and I surprised when he pries the top off the crate. To be fair, probably him more than me. Which brings me to Ho, the cat-fucking uncle. Among the many things I know is that Ho got a bum rap all those years ago. He was only 10 years old, and he was actually petting the cat. True, he had no pants on at the time, but if that is a crime, we would all be doing time. I myself often go about sans trial. Now, Ho is a little kid, who is just being friendly to the kitty, but his brother, who is Eddie Mushu's grandfather, is a rat, and not in the tasty sense of the word. And he makes up a tale of Ho molesting the cat, and tells it far and wide in the streets of Chinatown, so Ho is a hard path growing up, and consequently ends up quite a bit more squirrely than he might have from a childishly misguided session of kitty-fuck. Thus I was willing to give Ho a pass if he did not perpetrate these current hijinks. See, I'm having a pleasant early morning slide down the very alley when I find it necessary to croak the cabbage broad, minding my own business, when suddenly I pick up a tongue full of rat panic. It comes from above. So I take a gander over the top of some trash barrels. 5 or 6 of them arranged in a bunch, and each barrel full to the top, with various paper and vegetable trimmings and other detritus of the restaurant trade, which rats find attractive indeed, although I would not give a forked squirt of snake spit for all 6 barrels full. But what do I spy above the bok choy and carrot tops but 6 white rats, thrashing about on tethers, emanating many smells of distress and other delicious flavors. And I assume, squeaking to beat the brand, but I cannot say for sure, as I am more than somewhat deaf myself, although the vibrations I pick up across the trash seem to be saying, "Eat me, please, as I am deeply delicious." So, cautiously, I make my move, coming in from the side for the closest rat. For although these morsels are tethered in a star pattern, I do not care to get bitten because I am careless. So close, closer, and boom, bite, bite, bite. And the first guy is off to Never Neverland. I will move on to his pals and allow him to twitch and tenderize for a bit, which is an added benefit of venom. But as I'm going for the second rat, he rises up, as do all of his pals, and at the center of the star pattern there is a big bell-shaped straw gardener's hat, such as Japanese guys sometimes wear, with eye holes cut in it. In a twitch, I see that the rats are tied to the ends of the long, bare ribs what used to be an umbrella, and the ribs of the umbrella are attached to the crown of the hat, and under the hat is a guy, who is none other than Ho, the cat-fucking uncle, who has been crouching in the middle barrel. Oh, Ho, you have been unjustly maligned. You have been an outcast from your family over a falsehood. But I will give you absolution, catfucker. I will give you a seat by your ancestors. Where to bite? Where to bite? That straw hat will catch my fangs before they make purchase. Out of his barrel, Ho brings something round, points it at me, a mouth as wide as a blunderbuss. Not a gun, a fire extinguisher. Time to bolt, but it's cold. Colder than I've ever been. Colder than I knew it could be. Something slipped over my head, holding me, choking me. Bite, bite, bite. I hit nothing, so cold can barely move. Ho, you dirty son of a bitch, you got me. I should have seen it coming. The CO2 fire extinguisher slowing me down. So cold. I should have known, because I know things. My people know things. Hatch drove while Bailey in the passenger seat transcribed his notes by dome light from his pocket notebook onto a legal pad in disappearing ink. After each sheet of his pocket notebook was transcribed, he tore it out, lit it with a Zippo, and held it at the edges as long as he could without burning his fingers, then dropped it in the ashtray. Sometimes he let it burn the tips of his fingers. The ink on the legal pad would remain visible for only 5 minutes, so there was no second draft. The completed report would be put in a waterproof envelope and left in a dead drop specified by the voice on the phone. Later, it would be retrieved and couriered to Washington, where an agent with clearance would develop the invisible ink and read every other word to a blindfolded typist. Later, another typist typed every other word, after which the original would be burned and the ashes flushed down the can. Then the entire assembled typescript would be marked top secret, every word redacted except for conjunctions, and the whole thing filed in a locked cabinet in a locked room to which someone presumably had a key. Bailey was most nervous when writing the actual report, because it was then that Hatch might see something that he hadn't previously known about and start asking questions. Bailey wrote, "Body was packed in ice, in a crate, but upon examination showed signs of having been injected with some kind of poison. Agent determined that examination of the body by coroner might present a security risk to the project." "Why did we need to send the Italian up in the plane with the general?" asked Hatch. "Clearly someone else killed him and was going to dispose of the body." Bailey snapped off the dome light, annoyed. He hadn't mentioned the marks on Saltabelli's neck, and Hatch hadn't noticed them. "Contain it," Bailey said. "Gabelli was one of the general's connections here. We don't know how much he knew. Orders were to tie up the connection by putting them together. A murder would be investigated. A plane crash is just an accident." It was the longest speech Bailey had ever shared with Hatch, and he felt something. Was it shame? Still, he wasn't clear himself why they had transported the body, and he knew more about this operation than Hatch. "But why the woman? Clarence and Potter said she didn't know anything. Why put her on the plane?" "Orders," Bailey said. He didn't know why. The general, well, had opened a ridiculous hole in security that had to be closed, but some good time girl? Now Hatch had him questioning orders, which you don't do. A minute passed. Hatch said, "Won't whoever really killed Sal Gabelli know he didn't die in a plane crash?" Bailey thought, "That is a hole that will need to be filled." He checked his watch. "We call in for orders in 3 hours. Best not to ask questions." 2 minutes passed. Bailey flipped the dome light back on, resumed work on his report. The previous text had disappeared. He couldn't remember where he had left off. What had he written? He flipped the dome light off. Hatch said.
Done with the report?
Yes, Bailey said.
Hatch had noticed that Bailey had written less than half a page. A lot more than half a page had happened.
I'm having trouble seeing the road for some reason, Hatch said.
You're wearing your sunglasses, said Bailey. It's night. Take them off.
What about radiation?
It's only a theory.
Hatch removed his sunglasses, sighed in relief. 5 minutes ticked away. Cars passed, just moving lights and a whoosh as they went by. Fingerlings of fog were leaking into the valleys from the bay, still 40 minutes away. They washed over the car like flights of ghosts. Hatch said,
Hey, you ever feel like you might just be the construct of an unyielding, all-seeing bureaucracy beyond our perception that is molding humanity to its own will and pleasure?
All the time, Bailey thought. Sometimes when you're sleeping, Hatch, I sneak away and call my wife. Look at a picture of us together while she says my real name over and over, just to confirm that I really exist.
No, Bailey said.
Hatch nodded, drove in silence for a while, then said,
Ever think we might be just pieces in a self-building, evolving machine, forming itself to crush the human spirit?
Every goddamn day, Bailey thought. Pie, he said. When you start to think in that way, think about pie. Your favorite kind. Pie is real. Everything else is your mind trying to trick you.
What's your favorite kind of pie? Hatch asked.
I can't tell you that, said Bailey.
They drove in silence for 10 minutes. A sign said, City of Novato. But there was no town there, just a road. Hatch said,
I've never met a lesbian before.
Shut up, Hatch, Bailey said. Just shut the fuck up.
Hatch drove.
Blueberry, Bailey thought.
The entire town of Monte Rio consisted of a gas station and a tire-flattened raccoon. At 5:45 in the morning, the raccoon was the liveliest thing about it. First thing I saw was a sign carved in wood. School bus yellow against outhouse brown, with an arrow. Bohemian Grove. So my top-notch detective work of getting directions from Jimmy Vasco was paying off. From the river road, so-called because it runs along the Russian River, I could see the little gatehouse with a guy dozing behind the glass. So just driving in was not an option. Even if I could bluff my way past the guard, explaining the unconscious cop in the rumble seat might get sticky. I parked the Ford by a bin of old tires, behind a 2-pump gas station, unwrapped the blanket around Pookie, then gave him a couple of slaps to make sure he wasn't waking up. I still had an hour or so, I figured, based on Uncle Ho's instructions, before I had to jab him with the rest of the heroin. So I pushed him as far down in the rumble seat as I could manage, and covered his head with the blanket, so he didn't attract attention. And also, so the blanket would soak up most of his drool, so there wouldn't be a stream running down the side of the car. A quick check of the map. Looked like this dragon camp was maybe 300 or 400 yards up the road into the grove. If the cheese was there, I figured I should be able to get in, get her, and get out. A half hour tops. If she wasn't there, well, I didn't know. Maybe I'd start blasting guys until someone told me where she was, and save one for myself, in case I found out the worst about the plane crash I read about in the Examiner. It couldn't be her. Yeah, I read the story by the dome light on my way up. That guy I ran off the road outside Petaluma had no business driving at that hour of the morning and needed a roadside rest. Probably. I crossed the river road in a crouch, sneaky-like, and made my way into the woods about 50 yards parallel to the camp road. Myrtle was right. These were some heavyweight trees indeed. The bonus of which was, unlike the woods in Idaho, where I grew up, there was almost no undergrowth. So even in street shoes and a suit, and with a bum foot, making my way through this forest was a piece of cake. All due respect to Mr. Powers, the doorman at Mabel's, though, you can't tramp through the woods with a gun in your waistband, unless you got a boiler like Pookie's, and a seat cushion to match to hold it up. But on a lean guy like me, it slid down my leg. So I put it in my jacket pocket until further notice. In the city, on smooth ground, yeah, he had a point. I skated along the camps, most of them fenced off with split rails, to mark territory only, as split-rail fences are less than useless in keeping out skunks, bears, weasels, and even the random guy sneaking in from the city. There were big army wall tents in some camps. Others had permanent cabins, but none of these knobs was sleeping outside on the ground like real campers. Real campsites, I am told, seldom come with waiters, bartenders, and a staff of private park rangers. But then I do not hob among the knobs. While campfires might have raged the night before were only smoldering now. The only stirring was the occasional fat guy, stumbling out of a tent to have a sleepy whiz against a giant redwood. I passed a big log building that the map said was the dining hall. Trash cans out back and a couple of surplus ice machines chugging away under an awning. I crouched behind a tree that was as big around as a small house and checked my map again. The camps had names like Claim Jumpers and Rough Riders and other unlikely monikers as were probably bestowed by a banker from Knob Hill, imagining he was on an adventure. Dragons was only four camps up. Through the trees I could see a couple of little log cabins, a light on in one of the windows, which was small enough to be considered a gunport. There was also a mug in a ranger-type shirt standing by the front door of that cabin. Why would the Bohemians have a guy guarding a cabin, unless there is something in there of value? I hoped that thing was the cheese. I dodged from tree to tree till I was just outside the camp. With the cabin between me and the guard, I slid between the rails and got up against the wall by the window. A quick peek and my heart went drum solo. The cheese, sitting in the corner, party dress, surprise hair, looking like she was about to doze off. I didn't see the Pearl Dame. In fact, I couldn't see anyone else in there. So I assumed the Bohemians were just using this as their dame stockade, and they were doing their sleeping in the other cabins. I just had to take care of the guy by the door. I could pull the Walther on him, but if he yelled, I'd have to shoot a lot of guys, which I did not wish to do. So I figured I would sap him into Napland. He was not a big guy, about my size, which is to say average. So I figured I could maybe knock him out. But for all the trees and campfires, there was not one piece of firewood suitable for bludgeoning anywhere in sight. Now, during my boxing training, Lone Jones admonished me on many occasions to never hit a guy in the head with my fists if I could help it, as fingers break easier than a guy's coconut. But in this case, I had nothing but the Walther, and while it would do fine to ventilate a mug most dead, I was not sure about its sap potential. It is not a large pistol, and given how many times I had hit Pookie with the .45, which was much more substantial, I figured I'd have to put this guy's lights out with my own dukes. "But I've seen you hit a guy with your fist, Lone," I told him back then. "Show me. Well, you can't hit nobody with them little old bunny hands," Lone said. "You need to find you a brick or something." To appease my teacher, I slipped my belt out of the loops and wrapped it around my knuckles to protect and serve. I slid under the window and along the wall, and I got a good bead on the guard, as I could just see the tip of his nose around the corner. I took a deep breath and came around the corner in a full haymaker swing, my whole body in it, and the poor ranger guy must have heard my breath, because he turned into the punch. I caught him right between the eyes, and he completely changed direction, his head snapping back and hitting the door jamb. He went down like his bones had liquefied. Before I even got a chance to try the door, it opened. And there stood another medium-sized guy in a ranger shirt, freckled face with a red brush cut. "What did you do to Jeff?" he said, looking at his down buddy. Where this guy came from, I did not know, because he was not visible from the window. I didn't know whether to clock him or go for the gun in my jacket pocket. I started to go for the gun, since I was sort of bunched up with the knocked-out Jeff at my feet. But I forgot I still had my belt around my right hand, so I couldn't get my hand in my pocket. I started to panic, thinking the new guy was going to knock my block off, when the cheese pulled him back.
"I'll handle this, Rusty," said the cheese. "I know this bum."
Then to me she said,
"Sammy, what are you doing to Jeff?"
"I'm not doing anything," I said, and only then did I realize that without my belt my pants had fallen down to my knees, and I was standing there in my boxers and a suit coat, with my belt uncoiling from my right hand. So yes, I was doing something. I was panicking.
"What do you mean, nothing? It looks like if we didn't open the door, you'd be giving Jeff here the razzmatazz."
She looked over her shoulder at the ranger guy called Rusty,
And believe me, tomorrow poor Jeff would be crying in his coffee, and this bum would be down the road.
I would not. I did not. I don't even know Jeff.
It's just like you, Sammy. Have your way with poor Jeff and don't even get his name.
I finally threw my belt over my shoulder and pulled up my trousers. I'm here to rescue you.
I pulled the gun, pointed it at Rusty.
Why do you have a gun? Asked the cheese.
Because I'm here to rescue you.
I do not need to be rescued, she said.
Yes, you do.
These guys are holding you prisoner.
No, they aren't.
She turned to Rusty.
Are you?
He looked embarrassed. The ginger's skin was nearly transparent, except for the freckles, so he couldn't hide that he was blushing.
Sort of, he said.
You said we were just waiting for some guys.
Yeah,
said Rusty, talking to his shoes now, completely forgetting I had a heater trained on him.
But those government guys who went away with the general told us if we found you, we were supposed to keep you here until they got back. Mr. Stoddard told us to do whatever they said.
The cheese looked at me, shrugged.
Well, thanks, Tiger. I guess I do need to be rescued. Keep the gun on Rusty. He's shiftier than he looks.
Then she stepped over and knocked out Jeff, threw her arms around my neck and gave me a very big league smooch, as one might expect as thanks for having pulled off a rescue. She smelled of gin and cupcakes, and while that was mysterious in itself, I figured I would ask her about it later. I kept one eye on Rusty while trying to return the cheese's smooch with similar enthusiasm despite the distraction.
Is Jeff going to be all right? Rusty asked.
Yeah, if I don't shoot you both. Now get in there, over against the wall.
He did.
I handed the wall to Stilton. Here, Dal, hold this on Rusty. If he moves, shoot him. The safety is off. Just squeeze the trigger.
I don't know.
The cheese was reluctant. You don't have to kill him. Just shoot his dick off or something. With that, I had Rusty's full attention, and he stood against the wall so hard he started to merge with the logs. I put on my belt, then grabbed Jeff under the armpits and dragged him inside. He groaned a little, which was a good sign because killing a guy in a ranger shirt would have consequences, even if it was by accident. I took the gun from the cheese and backed away.
Rusty, you got any rope?
Nope, said Rusty.
That's too bad. I was just going to tie you guys up, but since you don't have any rope, I'm going to have to shoot you.
There's a boxer on the side of the cabin with tent stakes and rope, said Rusty.
You can use my flashlight.
He nodded to the flashlight on a hall tree by the door. Who brings a hall tree to a camp out? In fact, this whole cabin was somewhat nicer than my apartment, which I consider more civilized than a camp out.
Got it,
said the cheese. She grabbed the flashlight and was out the door in a blink. I could hear her rummaging around in a box outside, and before I could get any more of the skinny out of Rusty, she was back with a coil of cotton rope, such as one might use to secure a tent or tie up a couple of ranger guys.
Can I tie them up?
Asked the cheese, bouncing on her toes. She was pretty perky for a dame who had been up all night, but then so had I, and I was feeling pretty awake myself. I was conflicted, but I figured less could go wrong than if I let her hold the gun, and I really didn't want to touch Jeff now that she had made it weird. Yeah, tie up Jeff and we'll see how you do. Then I'll just shoot Rusty.
Hey,
said Rusty. But see how much better you're going to feel about getting tied up, huh? I said from the sunny side of the street. So, Rusty, these guys that went away with the general, black suits, black hats?
Yeah, and sunglasses, and it was dark. I don't think they could see very well.
They say when they'd be back?
Just before morning. They just said that if we found this dame, we were to hold on to her until they got back.
It was no longer before morning, and I was not feeling good about our timing.
Rusty, they have another dame with them? I ain't supposed to say. Mr. Stoddard, I can ask you again after I shoot your dick off.
Yeah, a skinny blonde, he said so fast he stumbled over the words. She had a little camera, but they took it away from her.
That's Jeff, said Stilton, pulling the last knot tied on Jeff's hands behind his back like a calf roper.
I'm from Idaho. It's the West. We have rodeos. Yes, also spuds. It was a pretty good tying job.
That's a pretty good tying job, I told the cheese.
She just winked at me, which meant thanks, pretty sure. Now you, Rusty, I told him, have a seat. The ginger sat in the chair I had seen Stilton sitting in, a basic oak kind of thing, and Stilton had him trussed up in a couple of minutes.
Gag him?
Asked the cheese.
Why not? I told her.
She went to a little bar cart on wagon wheels I hadn't noticed until now.
Wagon wheels?
Fuck these guys. She found a couple of bar towels, which she fashioned into gags.
Now, Rusty, said the cheese, very gentle and kindergarten teacher-like, open up. I'm not going to make it hard for you to breathe or anything, but if you yell, Sammy will come back and shoot your dick off. She grinned at me like a kid in a school play who just hit his mark for the first time. That's it, she said, and they were both gagged. Let's blow the stump. We gotta go through the woods, doll. You can't go in those heels. She was wearing some tall Mary Janes that matched the polka dots on her dress, but did not look suited for running through the forest. You watch me, she said. Once we were out the door, she closed and latched it, then threw her arms around my neck again and squeezed the breath out of me. I was so scared, she whispered wet into my ear. Really? I saw them take the general and that blonde girl away. What was all the bit with Jeff? I was improvising. Give you a chance to get the drop, I'm rusty. I smooched her lightly, gave her a squeeze. Not like a dame can think on her feet. And off, she said. It was creepy, the general. We gotta go, I said, letting her go. Tell me why we'd run. I took her hand and led her to the back of the camp, where she side-saddled over the split-rail fence. We followed the same route out that I took in, but now it was completely light, and there were a lot more fat guys wandering around, peeing on trees. Some ranger guys are building fires for them. I guess to give them something to stand around while they drank their coffee. As we went, the cheese whispered, pausing her story when we dashed to the next tree. The general likes me, I guess, she whispered, so let me play up to him, so Myrtle and that other girl can get away. Pearl, I provided. How do you know? She said. Myrtle got away. I helped her hide in the city. She's okay. Aw, ain't you just the aunt's pants? She pinched my butt, which was not something I was accustomed to, but apparently it was a sign that I was out of the doghouse. We crouched behind the same tree I had paused at on the way in, or one that was very similar, and I started to make the final dash for the river road, but she yanked me back. No, we gotta get something. Dal, those guys that took the general away are very bad guys. We do not want to be here when they get back. The general is no choir boy himself, said the cheese somewhat urgently. Look, when he gets me alone at that cabin, he gets very creepy, like he's never talked to a dame before, and I'm not having it. So he starts telling me how important he is, and how arranging to have us girls come up here was a mistake. He realizes now, but after the Bohemians see what he brought them, he's going to be one of the club, and on and on. About which I do not give a warm squirt of pee. So then he says he'll show me, and he opens this metal box he has stashed in the cabin like a big beer cooler, and shows me a special thing, and I think, uh-oh, this is trouble. So I bashed him over the head with this big crock they have under the bunks. Thing must weigh a ton and knock him out, and I take his prize and run. But it's too big for me to get it back to the city, so I stashed it. I figured I'd come back tomorrow and get it. But Jeff and Rusty caught me, so now we gotta go get it. And before I could say anything, she grabbed my hand and pulled me right into the camp, instead of away, where it was sane. Right to the big dining hall, right up to one of the big surplus ice machines, where she threw open the lid and said, ta-da, in the spirit of a magician who has just presented as whole a broad previously sawed in half. Ice, I observed. The cheese looked into the machine where there was, as I have pointed out, ice. She started digging like a dog at the beach, and ice was going every which way, and I was looking around very nervously, because it was not a quiet process. But she was determined and apparently in charge, so I kept trying to peek around her because there was not enough room in the ice machine for me to help. Then she seemed to have found something, tossed a few more handfuls of ice behind her, and stepped back, once again with a ta-da. I looked in. I didn't know what I was looking at. Maybe a rubber puppet. What? That's the Moon Man, said the cheese. Chapter 21 The Moon Man. As much as I would have loved to stand there making surprised noises and give in to going completely wacky over the cheese's Moon Man, I instead snatched that rascal up and commenced repeating, Holy shit, a friggin' Moon Man! Over and over as we ran. The cheese assured me she had a similar reaction when she first swiped him, and repeated, I know, a friggin' Moon Man, in response to my refrain. When we finally got the Moon Man back to the car, Pookie O'Hara, the naked, heroin-addled vice cop, was gone. I looked around, but there was no sign of Pookie. His clothes were gone, too,
along with the little leather box with the loaded syringe I'd left in the rumble seat with him, and half of my meatloaf sandwich, which I'd been saving for the cheese in case she needed sustenance after her ordeal. At least Uncle Ho had the big cop's gun, or I might really have had something to worry about. Pookie's hat was still on the seat, so there was a good chance he was not firing on all cylinders when he scrammed. "It's okay," I told the cheese. "I still have my receipt." I slung the Moon Man over one shoulder and pulled the receipt from my jacket pocket. The Moon Man weighed no more than a small kid, maybe 40 pounds, I'd guess, but I'd been carrying him for a couple of 100 yards through the woods, and he was starting to get heavy. The cheese snatched the receipt out of my hand. "Well, this is no good," she said. "It's in Chinese. Why'd you bring a knocked-out cop along anyway?" "Look, Dal, you are on very thin ice judging the company I keep," I said, tossing my head in the direction of the rubbery gray passenger I had over my shoulder. "I'll explain on the way."
"On the way to where?"
"Not here," I said. I put the Moon Man in the rumble seat and started to pack him down. He'd fit fine. I just might not be able to get it closed unless I mashed his melon a little. The dead Moon Man's body was skinny kid size, and only 4 foot or so tall, but his noggin was large economy size, shaped a little like a light bulb, with big almond eyes that were glossy black. In fact, they kind of matched the lacquered pearl-black finish on Jimmy Vasco's Ford, only more lifeless. "Prop him up in the corner," said the cheese. She grabbed the kimono that Pookie had left behind and tied it around the Moon Man's head like a scarf, then wrapped him up in the blanket so he looked like someone's granny who might be sleeping. Stilton does not mess around when it comes to getting stuff done. "There, let's go." She climbed in the passenger side and I got behind the wheel, and after a last quick look around for Pookie, we pulled out of the gas station to the river road just as a big black Chrysler went by and turned into the driveway to the Bohemian Grove. I turned the other way and took off nice and easy, trying to catch my breath, which had nothing to do with carrying the Moon Man. The cheese saw them too.
"Where did those guys take the general?" she asked.
"The general is dead, kid," I said. I slid the copy of the Examiner across the seat to her. It was fairy-folded open to the plane crash story. She picked it up, read, "Two others were killed in the crash. San Francisco saloon owner Salvatore Gabelli and an unidentified woman." She looked up.
"Pearl?"
"Yeah. And that's what they were going to do to you. I guess it's all been about hiding the Moon Man."
"But Pearl didn't see the Moon Man."
"Neither did Myrtle, but they are definitely after her, too. But it's just you three, I think. The other girls were sent back to Mabel's."
"So that's what the Ranger guys were holding you for? So those guys could put me in a sack?"
"Something like that. But first, they would have hurt you until you gave up the Moon Man."
"Never. He's mine." "Hey, when did this paper come out anyway? I saw the General and Pearl late last night."
"Trucks were throwing out the morning edition when I was leaving the city. Maybe 5 this morning."
"It says the plane went down in the hills outside of Napa. That's an hour out of the city." "Even if someone got to the crash right away, how could the Examiner know about the General and the other two so fast?"
"They couldn't. Those guys in the black suits had to have called it in. For one thing, Sal wasn't killed in a plane crash. He was dead long before that plane went down, and I had his body stashed in a box full of ice in the back of the saloon."
"You killed Sal?"
"He was a douchebag, but I didn't kill him. Whew. He had me going. My snake did." I let that news settle a little, as I was trying to figure out where to start. The cheese spun on the seat, leaned back against the car door, folded her arms across her chest, gave me the cocked eyebrow of inquisition, which I'm sure she learned from me. "I'm gonna explain," I said.
"Well?"
So as I drove, I explained about the Snake Whiz noodle joint, about the South African merchant marine getting me a black mamba, so Mushu's and I could make a fortune, about Lone clocking Pookie and stashing the cop with Uncle Ho, who knocked him out with heroin, about finding Myrtle and hiding her with Lone, although I left out the bit about Myrtle and Jimmy Vasco, as that was not my tale to tell, about the rats, about searching high and low for her, about Uncle Ho dumping Pookie on me at the last minute, and I finished up with busting into the Bohemian Club in the city and taking the map. Then I took my eyes off the road for a second to see how the story went over.
She said, "So these taxmen are going to be very upset that I have their moon man?"
"Looks like it."
"It'll see what the big deal is. The general said they have two others. A flying saucer crashed on the base that he was the boss of, so they have extras."
"And he brought one here just to impress the Bohemians?"
"Yeah. I get the feeling that the general is not the flying ace of keeping secrets. Not an ace with the ladies, neither, if I do say so myself. A very awkward old guy, and I have known some awkward guys in my time."
"What are you trying to say?"
I asked. "Oh, not you, Sammy. I mean..."